The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, January the 20th, 2026. It is 9:57 a.m. here in London, England, making it 3 minutes to midday over in Cape Town, South Africa, where my dear friend Dr. Peter Hammond is. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I'm with you, yes. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Peter. Great to have you on board, as I know the audience enjoys listening to you every Tuesday or whenever they catch up with the show during the week. ACHshow.com is the website where you can find the shows. And Peter also has a SoundCloud link where he has, I only host the last month's worth of my shows. When they're gone, they drop off the website. So get them while you can. But Peter has a SoundCloud, the link to which is in the post for all his shows that we do together at ACHshow.com. So that being said, today's presentation is entitled The Real Story of Esther. It obviously continues Peter's Bible studies, which relate to his Old Testament survey and New Testament survey books that are available from his websites, again, that you can find the links to in the post for this show. So, Peter, where would you like to start us off today with The Real Story of Esther?
Well, Esther is the original real-life inspiration for the Cinderella stories. And it's a dramatic, romantic, historical novel. And this powerful drama portrayed in Esther includes intrigue and suspense, love and hatred, pride and conceit, malice and conspiracy, revenge and murder, duty, honor, and courage. So the historical backdrop to the story of Esther is one of the most famous and dramatic chapters in world history. So Xerxes, the king of Persia, was about to launch his famous invasion of Europe. Now, his father, Darius I, had been defeated by the Greeks at the Battle of Marathon, which is remembered these days by marathon races, which my sons have competed in. Now, the Battle of Marathon was a dramatic defeat of the Persians, and that was Darius's army. And at the end of the Battle of Marathon, one of the men ran all the way to Athens to announce the victory, and he dropped dead. It was the absolute limit of his endurance. And since then, we've had the marathon race, the exact distance run from Marathon to Athens. And this is done worldwide as a test of physical endurance, running marathons. So that was the battle that his father, Darius I, lost. The historian Herodotus informs us that the occasion for the great feast, which is described in Esther chapter 1, was the planning for the campaign against Greek in the third year of Xerxes' reign. And Xerxes, also known as King Assessorus, he accumulated a massive army of reportedly 5 million men, which is mind-boggling logistics. Only 10% of these were actually Persians, and the rest were conscripted from the 127 provinces ruled by the Persian Empire. And Xerxes' engineers used over 670 boats lashed together to form two bridges across the Hellespont between Europe and Asia to enable his huge army, his massive, colossal army, to march from Asia into Europe. And indicating what a volatile individual Xerxes was, when a storm wrecked his first attempt of his engineers to complete a bridge across the channel, he ordered the Hellespont waters flogged and chained as a punishment for its tempestuousness. So, you know, not the kind of person you want to get into an argument with. He's not a very rational individual. So Xerxes' mighty Persian army was held up most famously by the 300 courageous Spartans under King Leonidas at the Pass of Thermopylae, which was a pivotal event. And the brave Spartans standing at Thermopylae at a narrow point through the mountains, holding up wave after wave of Persian troops who were thrown against these heroic Spartans. But they had chosen their battleground well. The Persian weight of numbers counted for little in the narrow pass of Thermopylae. And the skill and the courage and the strength of the Spartans frustrated every attempt to force the pass. And only the assistance of a Greek traitor who guided Xerxes' soldiers through a precipitous mountain pass to outflank Leonidas' Spartans enabled the Persian army to finally continue their southward march. But they had been delayed long enough for the rest of the Greek nations to mobilize and resist the Persian invasion. Now, Xerxes did burn Athens, but then he is decisively defeated by the Athenian navy at the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC. And with his naval resupply ships destroyed, Xerxes had no option but to withdraw from Europe. Athens was rebuilt, and a century and a half later, Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire and burned Darius III's capital at Persepolis down, and that was 331 BC. The very great palace of Xerxes at Persepolis, which Esther spent so much of her time, was excavated in 1930 by the Oriental Institute of Chicago. And the grandeur of Xerxes' palace can still be perceived in the vast halls and giant columns that archaeologists have discovered both in Persepolis and at Susa. So although the Book of Esther occurs in our Bible after Nehemiah in its order in the Bible, the events recorded in Nehemiah happened 30 years after Esther was crowned queen. So the events in the Book of Esther actually occur between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Ezra. And perhaps because of the books being written in Persia, these no doubt sensitive issues of the catastrophic defeats in Greece are not directly mentioned in the book. I mean, that's a wise, good reason why you wouldn't want to include those embarrassing details if these books are first being released in Persia. However, that was the historic backdrop. Xerxes' father, Darius I, had been defeated at Marathon. And when Xerxes attempted to complete what his father had begun, in seeking to subjugate Greece and ultimately Europe, his aspirations were frustrated at the Battle of Thermopylae and at Salamis. And the invasion of Greece occurs immediately after chapter 1 of the Book of Esther. And chapter 2 of Esther begins with the word later. Actually, it was 4 years later after Vashti was deposed and 2 years after Xerxes' armies had been frustrated at the battles of Thermopylae and defeated at Salamis in Greece. It's then that he married Esther. So that's the backdrop, that 4 years after Vashti was deposed, 2 years after the defeat, that's when Xerxes actually married Esther and made her his queen. Now, Esther was queen of Persia for 13 years. And Esther lived for many years after the death of King Xerxes, well into the reign of her stepson, Artaxerxes. And it's under Artaxerxes, under whom Nehemiah rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. And it's no doubt that Esther and possibly even Mordecai's influence created the situation which Nehemiah could receive support from Artaxerxes for rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, which we read in Nehemiah chapter 2. So Esther is only one of two books in the Bible named after a woman, the other being Ruth. And the great Bible commentator Matthew Henry notes that while the name of God is not mentioned specifically in the Book of Esther, the finger of God is everywhere evident, the romance of providence, as Matthew Henry put it. Well, while many in Israel may have felt that God was silent at the time of their captivity, it's evident God was still with them, even in exile in Babylon and in Persia. And while the prophets were silent, and while the temple was closed, God was still watching over his people. And while the kings of the earth feasted and forgot, God remembered. And with his hand, he wrote their doom, or moved their hands to work according to his perfect will. as we see in the books of Daniel and so on. Now, the book of Esther begins with a feast of the world's princes, and particularly Xerxes, and it closes with a feast of God's prince, Mordecai. And for a while, the enemy of God's people, Haman, is exalted, but in the end, Mordecai is exalted. In Esther, we see that God always has his man or his woman at the right place and at the right time. God has a remnant. Just as God positioned Joseph in slavery and in prison in Egypt in order to save his people from famine. And just as God had ordered matters so that Moses was brought up even in the household of Pharaoh to set his people free from slavery in Egypt. And just as God had prepared David, even as a shepherd boy, to lead his people Israel, so God prepared Daniel to be his witness in Babylon and Persia. And now we see Esther, the queen in Persia. Esther is the original real-life inspiration for all the Cinderella stories. Although her family would have been of noble birth, as Nebuchadnezzar first led the nobles of Israel away into captivity in Babylon when he captured Jerusalem, Esther was brought up in poverty, raised in obscurity. And her parents had died, both of them, so she was raised by her elder cousin Mordecai, who was a keeper of the gate, an official at the Persian palace at Susa. And it's important to study the book of Esther because it gives us a link in God's plan of redemption, an important chapter in the history of the people through whom God sent the Messiah. And secondly, the characters in the book of Esther vividly portray the consequence of both good actions and evil actions. What you sow is what you reap. And the story begins in the third year of Xerxes' reign in the winter capital, Shushan, also known as Susa, which was a citadel, strongly fortified palace. For 180 days, Xerxes has a conference with his officials and his nobles, the princes of the 127 provinces under him. And Xerxes shows them the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty. And no doubt this conference was to prepare for the coming invasion of Europe. Then Xerxes held a seven-day feast, and they served drinks with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king, and according to each man's pleasure. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, we read in Esther 1, verse 7 to 10, Xerxes ordered Queen Vashti to show her beauty to the people and to the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. And not surprisingly, Queen Vashti refused to be paraded before these drunken men. And she was holding a feast of her own for the women in the royal palace. And here we can see the capriciousness of Xerxes as he allowed his advisors to persuade him to summarily depose and to exile the queen. Now the scripture warns us, wine is a mocker and beer a brawler. Whoever is led astray by them is not wise. That's Proverbs 20 verse 1. We also read in Proverbs 22, 30, do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat. Romans 14 verse 21 says, it is better not to drink wine or to do anything else that will cause your brother to fall. And Proverbs 31, 4 says, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for rulers to crave beer. And you just think how many rash, foolish decisions have been made by individuals while they've been drunk, decisions they would never have made while sober. I certainly saw a lot of that in the army and in the fire brigade, that it's just incredible how people can become so stupid the more they drink, and then the louder they laugh at nothing, and the more ridiculous they behave. And in the morning, they're lying in their own vomit and so on. And then they say, oh, what a great party. And say, oh, wow, what happened? I have no idea. I can't remember a thing. Well, how do you know it's a great party? I've got this terrible headache and all the after effects of drunkenness, hangover and so on. And so, yes, here you see plainly in Esther how foolish it is to give ourselves over to strong drink. Well, after the disastrous defeat of Xerxes' forces in Europe, the king's servant proposed a national beauty competition. Nothing like distraction when you've had a great defeat. And so we read in Esther chapter 2, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan in the citadel, and let beauty preparations be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleased the king be queen instead of Vashti. And so the scripture records that Esther was lovely and beautiful. And there's not many women in the Bible that are specifically described in that way. So Esther was obviously extraordinarily lovely and beautiful. When the king's custodian, Haggai, met Esther, she obtained his favor. And he moved her and her maidservants to the very best place. After Esther completed 12 months beauty preparations, I mean, imagine that, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with perfumes in preparation for beautifying women. So she was having a spa treatment for effectively 12 months, preparing so her skin was as soft and her face as beautiful, her hair as beautiful as they could possibly make with all their different beautification preparations. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her, we read. And we read that the king loved Esther more than all the other women. She obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast of Esther and for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in all the provinces, gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. At about this time, while Mordecai sat in the gates, he overheard two of the king's doorkeepers plotting to assassinate the king. And Esther passed on Mordecai's warnings to the king, and inquiry was made, and the conspirators were executed. Now, at about this time, we're introduced to Haman, the son of Hammedatheth, the Agagite, and the king advanced him above all his princes. And Haman expected everyone to bow and pay homage to him as the premier servant or minister of the king. However, Mordecai, being a Jew, would not bow or pay homage to any man. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down to him or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the kingdom. And Mordecai's refusal to pay reverence to Haman dealt a blow to his pride. His wounded pride grew into hatred and an insatiable desire for revenge. Swelled with vanity and bitterly humiliated, Haman plotted the destruction of the entire Hebrew race. And to determine the day his enemy would be destroyed, he cast lots, which fell on the 13th day of Adar, or March, which was just 10 months away. Now Haman sought to misinform the king in order to obtain his consent. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed amongst the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. They're also different from all the other peoples. They do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it's not fitting for the king to allow them to remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatheth, the Agagite, the enemy of God's people. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you. Do with them as seems good to you." So here we can see how pride, rooted in selfishness, can lead to hatred, revenge, and murder. Now, of course, Haman could not have seen it at the time, but that's the final result of his vengeful spirit and his pride, which would be his own destruction. We have seen the capriciousness of Xerxes and the cruelty of Haman. And then in chapter 4, we see the counsel of Mordecai. When Mordecai heard of the decree to kill all his people in the kingdom, he put on sackcloth and ashes, which has always been associated with repentance and turning to God. And Mordecai informed the queen and counselor, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other of the Hebrews. For if you remain completely sound at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Which is a very prophetic term, because she was obviously coming to the kingdom for such a time as this. Then Esther told him to reply to Mordecai, "Gather all the Hebrews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days or nights or days. And my maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So in chapter 5, we see the courage of Queen Esther. Esther accepted the challenge and the counsel of Mordecai. Here we see her decisiveness, her resolution, her courageous action. She mobilized the people to prayer. Prayer moves the hand that moves the world. She's willing to risk her life by going in unsummoned to Xerxes. Now, remembering how capricious Xerxes could be and how he had deposed Vashti for not coming when he had called, she knew the penalty for anyone to appear before the king unsummoned was instant death. Yet she determined that even though it was against the law, she would go into the king unsummoned, and if I perish, I perish. It's most impressive that Esther had not been spoiled by her great beauty and by her beauty being recognized. She did not allow her character to be spoiled by her coronation as queen of the greatest empire of her day. She had not allowed the luxuries of her surroundings to turn her to selfishness or to arrogance. She was willing to risk it all and her life itself to do her duty for her people. And there's always something we must do. We need to do what is right, we need to do our duty, and we need to leave the results to God. Duty is ours, the consequences are in God's hands. We're commanded to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. We're commanded to rescue those being led away to death. We are commanded to care for widows and orphans in their distress. We are commanded to love our neighbor as ourselves. And we are commanded to take up our cross, deny ourselves, and forsake the world, to follow Christ, to submit to God, to resist the devil, and he will flee from us. And no one could tell what this fickle monarch would do, but Esther was determined to do her duty, to do what was right, no matter what the cost was. And the name Esther means star, and she certainly plays a stellar role in the constellation of God's people. Esther is a magnificent example of humility and modesty, obedience and courage, loyalty and constancy. We also see her wisdom. She had to move carefully. She was dealing with powerful and sinister forces, murderous forces. So prudent as well as fearless, when Queen Esther received the outstretched scepter from Xerxes and his warm offer to join her for dinner, she merely asked Haman and the king to join her for a dinner. If I've found favor in the sight of the king, if it pleases the king to grant my petition and to fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them. Tomorrow I will do as the king has said. And so Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. And when Haman saw Mordecai sitting in the king's gate and that he didn't stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. At home, Haman boasted of his great riches, of the favor he had received in the eyes of the king, now even in the eyes of the queen. Yet all this avails me nothing, he said, so long as I see Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. That's an amazing thing, how a person who has everything in terms of the world's fame and fortune, the prestige and power, yet he could be so completely obsessed as to be blinded to anything else. And have you seen some birds in your back garden fighting over a crumb when there's abundance of other crumbs enough for all the birds in the bird feeder? Yet three will fight over a single crumb and the other two will fly off after the one who finally gets a crumb, leaving uneaten so many other crumbs of bread on the grass or in the bird feeder. And so it is with too many people. Blinded by jealousy and envy, malice and hatred, many people are blind to their own blessings. And because of this resentment they have for another person, you can see Haman's wife, Zeresh, and his advisors and friends advising him, build a gallows 75 feet high in order to hang Mordecai on it. Now, in chapter 6, we see the consequences of choices. What you sow is what you reap. Well, that night, the king could not sleep. So he commanded one of his attendants to come and read the chronicles of the kingdom. And when he was reminded of the actions of Mordecai in alerting him to the conspiracy to assassinate him, Xerxes asked, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for doing this? And the king's attendants had to tell him nothing has been done for him. Now it's at this crucial point that Haman enters the outer court of the king's palace to want to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows he has prepared for him. But before he could ask his request, the king asks Haman, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman, supremely vain and prideful, thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And so Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. And then let this robe and horse be delivered into the hands of one of the king's highest nobles, and he must array the man whom the king delights to honor, and then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And then the king said to Haman, hurry, take this robe and the horse you have suggested, and do for Mordecai, the Jew who sits within the king's gate, leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. And just imagine the shock, the shame, the confusion of Haman as the tables are turned and he finds himself compelled to honor the same Mordecai whom he hated, whom he wanted to murder, to have to honor him, to honor his enemy in a way that he had hoped to be honored himself. Well, Haman hurried back to his house mourning and with his head covered, he bewailed what had happened to him, to his wife and to his friends. They ominously responded, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but you will surely fall before him. Pride comes before fall and a haughty spirit before destruction. While they were still talking, the king's officials arrived to hasten to escort Haman to the banquet, which Esther had had her servants prepare. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and the king asked, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. And then Queen Esther responded, if I found favor in your sight, O king, if it please the king, let my life be given at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. And King Xerxes demanded, who is he? Where is he who would presume to do such a thing? And Esther responded, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king rose up in anger and went into palace gardens. And Haman stood before the queen pleading for his life. And as Haman fell across the couch where Esther was, the king returned and thundered, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? And as the word left the king's mouth, the servants covered Haman's face with a cloth. And Harbonai, one of the servants, said to the king, look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf. It is standing at the house of Haman. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. This in Esther chapter 7. So what a man sows, that shall he reap. And Esther's one of the greatest heroines in all of history, because she served with wisdom and insight, with intelligence and courage. And one commentator writes, as an historical character, Esther is the supreme heroine. She delivers her nation from disaster. As a woman, she is that rare individual, a mixture of charm, strength, and guile, a human being whose character is secure from the rot of wealth and prosperity and power. And we see the catastrophe of evil character and the culmination of strong character. The king promotes Mordecai to the position so recently occupied by Haman. And although a law of the Medes and Persians cannot be rescinded, the king authorizes Mordecai to issue a new edict allowing the Judeans to defend themselves against the enemies. So what Haman had planned to be a great massacre of God's people is turned into a tremendous victory for God's people and a catastrophic defeat for the Agagites. And what King Saul had failed to deal with hundreds of years before with the Agagites had almost destroyed God's people. Back in Samuel 1 Samuel 15, King Saul had been ordered to destroy the Agagites, but he only looted them and left their people, especially the king, alive. And of course, it's the descendants of that Agagite who now are threatening Esther and her people. So there are three feasts in Esther. First, there's the Feast of Xerxes. Second, there's the Feast of Esther. And then finally, there's the Feast of Purim. The book of Esther closed with an account of the establishment of the Feast of Purim, a thanksgiving day for God's people. And although they had forsaken God, he had spared them. And to this day, the Purim festival is celebrated on the 14th and 15th of March, when the role of Esther is read in synagogues all over the world. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim and was recorded in the book. The book of Esther shows us what we sow, we shall reap. The book of Esther shows us the transitory nature of human grandeur and earthly splendor and the disastrous consequences of all ill-gotten wealth and possessions. Esther teaches us to seek God's guidance in times of difficulty, to learn to understand human nature so as to know how best to advance the cause, to be ready to renounce self and to be decisive in speaking up for those who cannot speak for themselves, to value and to seek the cooperation of fellow believers. It was in the reign of her stepson Artaxerxes that Nehemiah received permission to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And Jesus Christ is building his church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. We see God uses individuals. God preserves his people, and God intervenes in history. We all need to heed the counsel of Mordecai. When the time comes to speak up, we dare not remain silent. When the time comes to stand up, we must not remain seated. When the time comes to step up, we dare not hold back. We must be ready to contend for the faith, to fight the good fight of faith, to stand up for Jesus, to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. And each of us needs to learn from the resolute faith and the courageous example of Esther, who decisively declared, "I will go, and if I perish, I perish." Yet who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So why have you come into the kingdom, and what is God calling you to do? Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Very interesting. And while you've been going through that summary and that analysis of the book of Esther, that's led me to do a few questions. Now I'm going to give the audience the exact search term that I typed into Google. The reason I use Google is that's what the vast majority of people use, and we may well have our own beliefs on these matters, but I'm more interested in what the biggest search engine is teaching people. And so I'm going to give you the search term as well, in case you want to look into more, because obviously you could be looking into this search term for page after page after page. Now, some years ago, and I forget who it was, but somebody said on something I was listening to that the book of Esther was the only book in the Bible that did not mention God. So I typed into Google, which books of the Bible do not mention God? And underneath, I got the AI overview at the top. And this is what it says. The two books of the Bible that do not explicitly mention the name of God are Esther and the Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs in black brackets. Although God's presence is implied through providence in Esther and allegorically in Song of Solomon, with some translations noting a reference to Yah in Song chapter 8 verse 6. While Ecclesiastes is sometimes listed, it contains references to the Creator and God. So I then typed into Google, was Esther an Israelite? And the AI overview comes back and says, yes, Esther was an Israelite, specifically a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin, living as an exile in the Persian Empire, who became queen of Persia and saved her people from Haman's plot. She was raised by her cousin Mordecai in Susa and concealed her Jewish heritage until she revealed it to save her people from destruction. So I then went back to Google and I typed in this question. Are the Jews and the Israelites the same people? And this is the AI overview again. Yes, Jews and Israelites are fundamentally the same people, descendants of the ancient Israelites, but the terms highlight different aspects of their identity and history, with Jews becoming the predominant term after the Babylonian exile, for those from the kingdom of Judah absorbing other Israelite groups, while Israelites refers to the broader tribal confederation. Hebrew is an even older term, often used before the formation of Israel, but all three terms generally refer to the same ethno-religious group. But what I just said there, it says Jews becoming the predominant term after the Babylonian exile for those from the kingdom of Judah. And this goes back to the British Israel teaching that the Israelites of the Bible migrated to the West and they're the white Western Europeans today, but the tribe of Judah are the Jews. That was what British Israel taught. And so if we scroll down here just to see what the top result is below the AI overview, which is the answer to the search term, are the Jews and the Israelites the same people? The top post is a Reddit post that went up 30 years ago, and it says on it, I'll click on it, what's the difference between a Hebrew, an Israelite and a Jew? And the most popular search result from Big Boss 6121 7 years ago was, thought this was a setup to a joke, which obviously isn't the result that we're looking for. But below that, by Rosen 7 years ago, writes as follows: Hebrew is a biblical term for Abraham and his descendants. Israelite is a term used in English translations of the Bible to describe the children of Israel who crossed the desert after the Exodus and who settled in the land of Israel. Jew is a word which developed from the anglicization of the label for someone who, from the kingdom of Judea, in brackets Yehudi. The theocratic kingdom had a series of laws and membership in the nation equated with adherence to and identification with those rules stroke that religion. So there you go. There's a lot of different information down there, and there's even if you there's 9 replies to that that statement, which seems to have generated some discussion, and that includes one of them that by deleted, well, it's been deleted but it's still there, from 7 years ago: anybody who calls themselves an Israelite or Hebrew today is 99% guaranteed not to be Jewish and most likely is a black Christian. So that's your they call them the black Israelites, that sort of group out there as well. So there's all sorts of different claims as to this term and how it works out. I'm sure many of you have heard them before. Peter, any comments on what I've just read?
Yes, well, I noticed as I was doing my survey of the Old Testament that the word Jew doesn't appear in the Bible before the book of Ezra. And in fact, historically, the people were Hebrews until the nation, the unified nation, the United Kingdom, was established under King Saul, and they became Israelites, and then under David and Solomon. And then under the son of King Solomon, the United Kingdom split into the nation of Israel in the north and Judea in the south. And only Benjamin joined Judah, and therefore they got wrapped up under Judeans. But the northern tribe of Israel, the northern 10 tribes of Israel, were conquered in the 8th century BC by Assyria, and they were sent into exile, mainly up into the Caucasian Mountains, which is between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And that's why many Europeans are called Caucasians, because the 10 lost tribes of Israel moved into north and west and ended up in, well, you know, the Saxons are Isaac's sons. And you can see how the children of Dan, well, there's the Danube River, there's Denmark, and so on. And you can see so much of even the Goths, those of God, so much of, whether it's the Angles, the Saxons, these are the lost tribes of Israel, and they've got the evidence for it. So if a person talks about Moses led the Jews out of Egypt, well, that's anachronistic terminology. That's like talking about the conquistadors landing, you could say something like Christopher Columbus discovered the United States of America. No, he didn't. There was no United States of America before 1776. In fact, he was an Italian serving a Spanish king, and he discovered the Americas And he thought he had landed in the West Indies. I mean, when I speak about the West Indies, they were trying to go to the east by sailing around to the west. So it was called the West Indies. And the reason why the people in America are called Indians, the indigenous people who were there first, is because they first thought they'd landed in India, but they hadn't landed anywhere near India. It's a misunderstanding. I've got similar problems where I live in South Africa. We've got a place here called Tiger Valley, but no tigers have ever lived in Africa. The early settlers who came here misunderstood when they saw some leopards and they called them tigers. So we've got a place called Tiger Valley, even though there's never been any tigers in the Cape, let alone in Africa. And that's just showing the ignorance that you get from some people when they speak about the Jews in Egypt. Well, no, they weren't Jews. They were Hebrews. And then when they established the nation, it was called Israel. And when the nation was divided, you had the Israelites in the north and you had the Judeans in the south. And after the Babylonian exile, the Judeans who went into exile into Babylon and were corrupted by Babylonian occultism and the Talmud and so on, the exiles who went into Babylon were called Jews. And for people today to mix Jews and Hebrews and Israelites like they're the same thing, you know, it's like when Tucker Carlson was interviewing Ted Cruz and he says, what is Israel and who are Israel? And does the Bible tell us to support the government run by Netanyahu in the Middle East? And Ted Cruz says, yes, it's all the same thing. Well, no, it is not actually. And we don't want to be biblical illiterates. It's not accurate. You know, for me to speak of Jan van Riebeck discovered South Africa, no, there was no country called South Africa before 1910. And so he came to the Cape of Good Hope. They first called the Cape of Storms, but that wasn't good for tourism. So we later renamed it the Cape of Good Hope, which is a whole lot more positive, better for tourism as well. But the Cape was later forced to join with the Transvaal and Orange Free States after the Anglo-Boer War. Without a referendum, the Cape, Natal, the Orange Free State and Transvaal were renamed the Union of South Africa. So you can't anachronistically refer to a place in the 1600s in its general area as South Africa and so on. There's so many things that have changed over the years. Just like you can't say that the Saxons invaded the United Kingdom. There was no United Kingdom back when the Saxons invaded Angleland. And England comes from the term Angleland because of the Angles. The original Bretons or Celts who lived in Britannia were Celts. And, you know, again, you can see that the Celts became part of Britain. But again, Britain, the southern part of Britain, were conquered by the Saxons and were renamed Angleland, England, after the Angles, who were a primary group. The Jutes came in and so on. And time and again, you can see there's a change, there's a development. And just like you can't speak about the Saxons invaded Germany, well, it wasn't a Germany back when the Saxons first moved into Germany and so on. You've got to look at the history, and it's just bizarre how there's been deliberate confusion and biblical literacy and ignorance on display as people refer to Moses as a Jew. Well, Moses was not a Jew. And so on and so forth. You can see,
sorry,
even
Peter,
the Apostle Paul, he was of the tribe of Benjamin. Very inaccurate to just take this broad paintbrush. Yes.
Sorry, when you said Moses was not a Jew, I think when you said Moses was not a Jew, you completely cut out for a while, like someone's trying to block our connection. Can you just say what you said after Moses was not a Jew, please?
Moses was a Levite. He's of the tribe of Levi. So you can say Moses was a Hebrew. You can say Moses was a Levite. But you cannot say he's a Jew. That term wasn't to be used for another 1,000 years. It's only after the Babylonian captivity that the Judeans who went into exile to Babylon, who came back, were called Jews. And so Judeans only start to be called Jews, obviously an abbreviation, a bit of a corruption of the term, in Babylon. And So the Jews are actually directly linked to Judeans who went to Babylon. And to suddenly take the term, and now it includes atheists and converts to Judaism, even from Khazar, the tribe of the Khazars in what today is Ukraine, who converted to Judaism because they were stuck between Muslims on one side and Christians on the other, and they came up with this bright idea that if they convert to Judaism, they wouldn't be the enemies of either the Christians or of the Muslims. They could get a protected status. And they started to predominate in especially money lending. So the Khazars are often called the 13th tribe, not a drop of genetic blood of Abraham in them, but the Khazars are now effectively many of the people who today call themselves Jews are descendants of the Ukrainian tribe of the Khazars. And this is accepted even by Jewish historians. They've even got a book out on it. It's recognized at the museum in Tel Aviv. The Khazars are converts to Judaism. They, in fact, it's been pointed out now that the average Palestinian in Gaza might have more Abrahamic DNA than the average Israeli citizen who's considered Jew, because not everyone who calls themselves a Jew today actually is a descendant of Abraham. Many are descendants of the Khazars who converted to Judaism and so on. So there's a lot of confusion about the term Jew, which makes this idea that somehow, you know, the DNA in their blood is magical and special and so on. Well, in many cases, if you checked, there isn't that much DNA that dates back to Abrahamic Hebrews. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And I think the most famous book about that is The 13th Tribe by Arthur Koestler, which I remember having a copy, but I think it wasn't a long book. It's only a short book, but I found it a sort of difficult read for some reason. But there you go. That's where a lot of that information, I believe, comes from. But thank you for your input on that, Peter. Now, something else that when we close out the show, Peter gives you his website. He gives you his email address, which, again, are in the post for the show, achshow.com. He also generally gives you a Facebook page because he's very active on Facebook, and he's not going to be doing that anymore. Peter, can you please let the audience know what's happened here?
Yes, well, it's the situation has dramatically changed. My Facebook page has been, over the years, I've gotten a lot of shadow banning and a lot of being in Facebook jail and for saying things that shouldn't be said. You know, truth is hate to people who hate the truth. And truth doesn't fear investigation, and the truth will set you free. But in Facebook, it can get you put in Facebook jail or deplatformed. So I was informed a week ago after I went through a month in December of having no Facebook access at all. And then suddenly, in the first week of this year, I was informed that they are deplatforming me. They are deactivating my page. And since then, we've discovered that they've deactivated a whole lot of pages that I helped set up and that were linked to my name. So including our Frontline Fellowship, Reformation 500, Young Reformers Out to Change the World, the Flame Lily Foundation, Cape of Good Hope, all deplatformed. Wonderful Wildlife, which had 10,000 followers and a 50 million reach with millions of engagements in a single year, deleted. We Love God's Animals, the Gospel Defense League, Livingston Fellowship, a whole lot of these pages. There's 30 pages I've set up over the years. And just last year, collectively, these pages reached over 2 million people with thousands of engagements and comments and shares, even with all the shadow banning and throttling and stifling of any kind of Facebook activity. But now they've totally taken them out and they are invisible. I'm deplatformed, deactivated, and they said there's no appeal allowed. This is permanent. And, well, in fact, we are appealing through some attorney general's offices in America, in Alabama, for example, that this is not right. And under Commercial Protections Acts, we are seeking a restoration of these pages illegally, but nevertheless, at the moment, because even my Back to the Bible movement page, all deactivated, Dr. David Livingston, all of these. So anyone trying to get hold of me, needs to use email. WhatsApp can work as well. I'm experimenting with getting onto Gab, trying to get onto some of these non-censorship platforms, but my Facebook profile is removed, deactivated. And I've tried using different email addresses to get back on to Facebook, even under different identity, and blocked in every way. They are really trying their best to make sure I never get onto the social media platform again. I must have said something that upset them. Now, they haven't told me what. They just said that my posts go against the community standards, whatever that means. Well, I think the community standards are, you know, supporting anti-Christian woke agendas. We know that Facebook support the lockdown lunacy, the masquerade madness, the COVID cult, the salvation by vaccination COVID cult. Because in 2020, they even admitted before Congress, Mike Zuckerberg admitted that they deleted over 12 million posts in 2020 to keep the whole COVID cult going. And obviously, they don't like free speech. I think this is very much like what George Orwell warned in his 1984 book. When you have thought crimes and you must engage in double think and newspeak, or the thought police are going to unperson you and you're going to disappear down the memory hole. Well, this is what this means. This is now mini truth is at work. And isn't it interesting? Tucker Carlson reported 4 times more people were arrested in Great Britain for thought crimes and free speech violations in Great Britain last year than the whole of Russia, which is in the middle of a war and which has a vastly larger population. So even the fact that a grandmother could get arrested for praying on the street in London, absolutely extraordinary that we've got what George Orwell warned us about. Mini truth, thought police, and you must engage in newspeak and double think or you will be unpersoned and disappear down the memory hole. So sorry to report back on that, but if anyone's wondering why they're not seeing me on Facebook or why I'm not responding to Facebook Messenger, well, the simple answer is I cannot. And, you know, we're dealing with the globalists, with the powers that should not be, and they obviously love censorship. I'd call them the politically correct censorship industrial complex. And you might as well know about that, that, you know, the thought police strike again. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And it's interesting as well that supposedly America is pushing to stop all this censorship, but Facebook is an American company, and it's quite surprising that they're still doing it. But then there are arguments from people when you hear in the mainstream media that Twitter, now Musk's X.com, there's all these claims in the mainstream media, he allows anyone on there, and you know, it's not right and people should be censored. It turns out that there are people on there that were banned, but a lot of people that were banned have not been allowed back, and it seems to be very cherry-picking the sort of people that are allowed back on there, almost as if they have, they can be contrary to a certain popular view, but they can't, there are certain views they simply cannot have on X. Have you thought about, because the one thing you didn't cover is X.com, is that a platform you've thought about going on to, Peter?
I have, but it's the way my IT people describe it, it's quite complex. And the only way it can work is you've got to make multiple postings every single day, and I don't think I've got the time for that. It looks like X is a bit too demanding in the algorithms, that I will get no traction and coverage and reach unless I'm really fully engaged. And if you want to put a certain amount of length of materials on, you've got to pay in for the premium account, and I'm not willing to do all that. I'm a book person. I was brought up in a bush in Rhodesia, and to me, I know books. I went to theological seminary. I understand one-on-one personal evangelism, rallies, public speaking, lectures. That's my field. Social media is more technical than I need, and they keep changing the algorithms. You might recall there was a time when Facebook was pretty free and open, but then came Brexit in 2015 and then the Trump revolution 2016. And it's like all the powers that should not be woke up and said, no, wait a minute. Facebook was meant to be how we can eavesdrop on you, and you meant to just be posting this, a picture of the cafe latte or whatever that I got from Starbucks today, and here's a picture of my burger at this venue and so on, and selfies of me and somebody. You're not meant to use this for evangelism and for political action. And when all the media opposed Brexit vote in 2015 and Brexit won only through social media, and then Trump won the White House in 2016 only through social media, suddenly after 2016 you saw massive amounts of censorship and algorithms and violating community standards and all this nonsense. And that's, and of course it got even more extreme in 2020. They went absolutely berserk. There were things I'd post within seconds. It would be, you know, fake news. And well, how would they know? They wouldn't have had time to even read the post. Like within seconds of me posting something against the masquerade madness or the lockdown lunacy or the COVID cult, the fact checkers would lock it down. So the fact checkers must be the modern equivalent of what George Orwell called the thought police. And, you know, it's absolutely clear that what's going on is the powers that should not be are clamping down on free speech. If you want to know who rules the world, recognize who you're not allowed to criticize, as your show always reminds us. Truth does not fear investigation. Truth is truth even if no one believes it. A lie is a lie even if everyone believes it. And we should not be afraid of speaking the truth, and we shouldn't be afraid of investigating, because the truth will set you free, as your program begins. Jesus said that in John 8:32. You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Censorship is anti-freedom. But what we're seeing is serious censorship. Now, I obviously, as a Christian missionary, I'm not putting on foul language, pornographic pictures, anything. Everything is evangelism. It is discipleship. It affects its history, a lot of history, and there's a lot about wildlife. And I've been sharing lots to do with nature conservation and so on too. But that's the full substance of what I've been posting. And for them to say it violates the community standards, well, it means they hate history or hate the Bible or hate the truth, because that's about all I'm ever sharing on my pages. And anyone who's seen what I've posted knows where I stand. I'm a reformed, God-fearing Christian, and I believe in evangelizing and fulfilling the great commission of our Lord Jesus Christ. If they've deplatformed me and Gospel Defense League and Reformation 500 and Frontline Fellowship, which is a mission to the persecuted church, our International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted, even that page is down. So they seem to say that all that I stand for violates community standards of Facebook, whatever those standards are. But I think their standards must be the woke, gender, climate cult, COVID cult. Obviously, their community standards have nothing to do with normal people like you and I. Well, if we can dare call ourselves normal these days. It seems common sense isn't even that common anymore. Back to you, Andrew.
Yes, I agree, Peter. And I mean, I've always been, with social media, it amazes me, not just social media, but this platform idea, things like YouTube. I remember Alex Jones once saying that he was stopped in when he lost his YouTube account. About a month later, you were stopped in an airport. Oh, I used to watch you. Oh, have you stopped? You've obviously stopped doing your show. And people just don't think. A lot of people don't anyway. I'd always know what his website was. Another thing happened with a guy called Rick Wiles, who was a place called True News. If I wanted to look him or Alex Jones up, I would go to truenews.com for him and infowars.com for Alex Jones. I would know those websites. And these aren't people that I go to. It's just, I'm giving an example that many people would be familiar with, and it's amazing to me that they're able to be so effective at shutting people off. People will just, you know, if I couldn't find someone on a certain platform, I'd be looking elsewhere. But it seems that most people just think, oh, they're not on there, so they must have stopped doing what they were doing. They won't bother looking elsewhere. And so it's the, what's yes. the right word? It's just the lethargy.
Very, very sad. Yeah. I've even had people ask me, are you still involved in your mission? As though I would just stop. And, you know, we haven't heard from you. Well, it's just because the pages have been removed or deplatformed and so on. But obviously, I'm never going to stop. And the idea that, you know, did you get distracted or get bored and you're off doing something else, it's kind of insulting. But there are people actually assume, well, you know, we used to see you so active on Facebook. Well, it's not like I haven't been active. It's just that the sense have been more active.
Yeah. And I think the other thing as well is you look at some of the people that have been allowed on X, and these are people that have been, you know, have openly make comments that you think would be blocked, you know, people who talk about race, things like that. And that's not something that you talk about. You preach to everybody, regardless of race. In fact, you probably help more blacks than you do whites, being based in Africa. Although you've done missions all over the world, the majority have been in Africa. And you would think that they'd be appreciative of somebody who reaches out to everybody when they've got people on their platform that clearly don't. So it appears to be, by going after you, they're actually going after Christianity. What are your thoughts on that?
I would think so. And I've got millions of Africans who love what we do. And I've spoken to culminatively many millions of Africans, for add the people in the Congo, Nigeria, Sudan, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Angola. And being on their radio and TV programs and speaking at big rallies and even in some stadiums, massive, some of the biggest churches around, I've spoken at conferences of thousands of African pastors and youth. And I've got so many millions of African supporters who would be horrified and amused to hear that I'm dismissed as a far-right extremist racist in some parts of America or Britain, which is, you know, we're not far-right, we're just right so far. And when they call me a conspiracy theorist, well, I don't know if there's any theories out there that haven't been proven to be conspiracies. There are a lot of conspiracy facts. The term conspiracy theorist was first cooked up in 1963 after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And if you didn't believe the official narrative of a single gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, on his own with his Italian bolt-action rifle from that one window up in this repository, shot all those shots from the different directions and the magic bullet that could change direction, go all over the place, to explain how just three bullets could have done the damage they did. And mind you, he was shooting blind through trees that were covering the area too of where the shots were landing. So much of the story doesn't match. If you didn't believe the narrative of lone gunman, no conspiracy, Lee Harvey Oswald, you were called a conspiracy theorist. Yet now enough facts have come out to prove without a shadow of a doubt that all the shots couldn't have just come from that one place. And Lee Harvey Oswald may have been part of it, but he certainly wasn't the only one. And he was part of a broader conspiracy. Some people think he was just a patsy and he wasn't even involved, except being set up. Well, at any rate, the evidence is overwhelming that a lot of the evidence has been covered up by the CIA, by the FBI, by the Supreme Court even of the United States, were involved in the cover-ups. Because the Warren report was a complete cover-up. And now we know that the government was involved in covering up. So it was a conspiracy, not a theory. It's a conspiracy fact. Well, that's where the term conspiracy theorist came up from. And now it's been proven, well, it really was a conspiracy. And it wasn't just a single gunman acting alone, lone gunman and all that sort of thing. So by now, we shouldn't be getting intimidated with all these terms of, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist. Well, actually, all our conspiracies have been proven to be facts. So maybe you could give us a new conspiracy theorist, because all of ours have been proven to have been conspiracies. There's no more theorist about it. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And that is a good place to wrap it up today. So before we go, can you please let the audience know how they can contact you and where they can find your work?
Yes, well, by God's grace, my email still is operational, peter@frontline.org.za, peter@frontline.org.za. And our website, www.frontlinemissionsa.org, frontlinemissionsa.org. www.theoldchurch.org. That's our website. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. Interesting information as always. So, you can find the email address that Peter just mentioned, along with the website and many of his other websites, at the post for the show at achshow.com. Peter and I'll be back with you again next Tuesday. I'll be back with you all tomorrow. And until then, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye for now.